This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 297 was recorded on November 11th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Saxo Bank Commodity Strategy Chief Ola Hansen returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the outlook for commodities with the macro backdrop of secular inflation, which Ola sees on the near horizon, including a discussion of whether gold, copper, or other commodities will be the best inflation hedges for what lies ahead. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Tour of the Commodity Markets.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump straight to talking markets here. S&P 500 had a run where almost for a month it was going up almost every single day. We cleared 4,700 on the upside. And here we finally get the market pausing. A little bit of a thing that I wouldn't even want to call this a market correction because it's just not deep enough. But finally, maybe the inflation numbers kind of spooked the market a little bit. What's your take? Is there more upside for the market from here?
I think there's plenty more upside. The thing that I find most interesting about this, Patrick, is the way people are reacting to it. What we had, Patrick, as you alluded to, was 16 out of 18 consecutive trading days being huge up candles. And then we got two tiny little down days, not even getting all the way down to the 13-day moving average. And I hear people freaking out about how the market is crashing online. Look, this is not a crashing market. If you guys want to know over in the equity world what volatility looks like, come on over to the crude oil pit. We've got volatility there. Honest, for sure. This is not volatility. This is not a correction. This is not even a hiccup. This is an actual down day, two of them in a row. Oh my goodness, after 18 up days. We've got, I'm concerned, Patrick, that there is so much complacency that someday when we actually do see downside in the market, people are really going to freak out. But for what I see here, there's no reason for concern.
All right. Well, let's move on to the dollar index. I'm going to have a chart in the post game on it, but it finally broke out of its 1 month range highs above 94.50. Do you think there's something behind this?
Well, I think it's fascinating that both gold and the dollar broke out, very much consistent with a prediction we've had here on Macro Voices for years. You know, a lot of people think that gold and the dollar just have to be inversely correlated all the time, and clearly that's not the case. But finally, we got something to talk about. We do have this, clearly upside breakout in the dollar beyond its trading range. You know, I am convinced that the Luke Groman view about the dollar fading out of relevance is going to be proven right in the end someday. But I don't think someday is here yet. And I think the Brent Johnson view that we've had on the program quite a few times in the past, describing the reasons why, even though maybe the dollar's prominence as the world's global reserve currency is slowly coming to an end, that slow coming to an end process is likely to happen in the form of dollar scarcity and the dollar index increasing, not decreasing, into this. So I think maybe we're seeing the beginning of Luke being put on hold and Brent being proven right, at least in the short term. But let's give it a few more weeks and see what happens. This is a brand new trend.
Yeah, what I'm watching there, the euro has a whole bunch of different, like the one level I'm interested in is if the euro gets down to about the 113 level. And so there's a little bit of further room for this follow through, but we're going to come to, I think, a pretty interesting technical level. I'll be watching for sure. Let's talk crude oil though, Eric, because it really looked like that at the start of the week that crude oil was setting up for a break to new highs, like maybe 90 was in the cards, and pretty strong reversal day the other day. And the question now is what's your take here? I mean, is this just a pause and the crude oil is still poised to go higher on, or is this consolidation going to continue?
Well, I wouldn't even call it consolidation. I would call it extreme volatility in the face of White House-driven political theater. And to be sure, it's theater. It's not economic reality, folks. So what's going on here this week? Prices were up and up hard on Wednesday afternoon when API, that's the private service, not the government service, reported a drawdown in crude oil inventories. And of course, seasonally, we should be expecting builds this time of year. So a drawdown is a really bullish signal. That took us up not quite to last week's highs, but pretty darn close, or 2 weeks ago highs, I'm not sure. As you say, it looked like we were hitting almost 85 there, breaking out to the upside, seemed like there was just, you know, no limits to things. Then we got a combination of data reports on Wednesday. The EIA inventory report shows crude oil building 1 million barrels nationally, not drawing down. Well, okay, wait a minute. Look a little closer into that data. What it really shows is that the commercial oil drew down 2.1 million barrels. Then there was a release of 3.1 million barrels out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Net, that results in a build. But if you don't consider the Strategic Petroleum Reserve release, then there really was a drawdown, and it's a non-seasonal drawdown, and it should have been kind of a bullish signal. What else do we have in the data? Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 34,000 barrels, not nearly as big of a drawdown as we've seen in recent weeks, but as we get to finished products, still big drawdowns. Gasoline, 1.6 million barrel draw. Distillates, 2.6 million barrel drawdown. Boy, a lot of stuff being drawn down. Seems like that should be super bullish. Why wasn't it? Well, the reason is combination of U.S. inflation data, the dollar breaking out, and mostly, I think, President Joe Biden jawboning, talking about how he's going to battle with OPEC Plus and blaming OPEC Plus for current energy prices and so forth. What we have, just to pull the big picture together, Joe Biden or any other president of the United States really has zero influence directly on supply and demand of crude oil. And frankly, I think all of this is political theatrics. But these are political theatrics being undertaken by the president of the United States. And that means just those theatrics can result in a tremendous amount of market volatility. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, there could be plenty more volatility. I'm not at all convinced that the bottom is in yet. But in the end, I am convinced that we're moving much higher in crude oil prices as we come finally to actually face reality, which is Joe Biden has no say in the fact that the fundamentals, some of which, by the way, are created by Biden administration policy, are very much favoring much higher prices to come. But they're not going to back off easily. There's a lot of political pressure on the White House right now to do something about OPEC Plus. So you can expect the White House to continue to play this political volley game. And I expect that the crude oil market is going to be whipsawed as a result of that. Buy the dips is my feeling here. I think we're going much higher, but maybe not for a while until all of this political theater is behind us.
All right, so let's talk gold. Like
There's something to talk about gold.
Yeah, like I have a great chart I want to show actually in the post game. But look, we've been in this trade range for it feels like a year, but it's only like the real kind of sideways consolidation has been since the summer. But finally, that trade range has been resolved to the upside at least for one day. I mean, I don't know whether we want to already do a victory lap that the bulls are back, but certainly some price action out of the trade range. What's your take?
Well, our regular listeners will remember just a couple of weeks ago, I was kind of criticizing the gold bug community who were saying, oh, look, there's a breakout in gold. And I was saying, look, that's not a breakout. But gold poked its head above a moving average for like 2 days and then reversed. That was a fake breakout, not a real breakout. Channeling Joe Pesci here, Patrick, this is what I call a freaking breakout. This is real. The thing is, it's real, but the level that we care most about, which is around 1833 or so, that's the level that we're only a couple of days into this. Now, it looks really good because we got there through that level after a breakout from the moving averages down around 1800 or so. And as we approach that next resistance at 1833, it slowed down only for a day or so and then broke above it. And now we're continuing to break above. Really looks good. But I think what's much more interesting here is not the action in gold, but the correlations, because gold is breaking out to the upside at the same time that the dollar index is breaking out to the upside. and at the same time that crypto continues to do very well. Remember, one of my theories has been that the reason that gold has struggled here is that it's competing with crypto for a lot of market share. A lot of people think that crypto is the new gold. I don't happen to agree, but a lot of people think that. Well, we didn't see, you know, if this was a something went wrong in crypto land and everybody was afraid of crypto being outlawed and they all piled into gold, that would have made logical sense. That's not what happened. We see strong crypto, strong US dollar, strong gold all at the same time. I think what it's telling us is that people are realizing that we really are pretty much beyond any point of no return, so to speak, in terms of monetary policy. We're going to keep devaluing the currency, and that's why gold and the cryptocurrencies are doing so well. But hang on. If that's really the macro driver, how do you explain all of this strength in the dollar index? Now, that is relative to other currencies, but you know, it's really interesting to look at those correlations. So that's something I'm going to be looking at in the week ahead.
So, Eric, though, I want to talk that 10-year treasury yield, because all of the things you just said about why gold was breaking and the dollar moving, you would think that the bond market would give a shit. And here we are at yields at 155, and clearly the bond market is not, at least on the longer end of the curve, really showing any major concerns. Do you think that this is just a matter of time before the bond market does, or is this just simply just a different story?
You know, I don't claim to know, Patrick, and you know, to go back to my Joe Pesci. If you want to talk about the 10-year yield, you can talk about it, because I don't know. I look at this. The one thing I do notice is I look at T-bills. Now, for a long time, we had just crazy, crazy low, almost nothing yields at the front end of the curve, and that's still true. 3-month T-bill yielding 4 basis points. 6-month T-bill yielding 6 basis points. 12-month T-bill yielding 15 basis points. Still tiny little numbers. Hey, wait a minute. Look at the 2-year, 51 basis points. Okay, I know it sounds crazy to say 51 basis points is a high rate of return, but if you look at the progression, it seems like between the 1-year and the 2-year, you're seeing a much bigger lift in yields there. So something's changing in terms of the structure of the curve. I don't know what's driving it. You know, I'd love to get a Jim Bianco or another really heavy fixed income guy on to talk about what's going on, not just with respect to where the 10-year is, but the shape of the curve and what's affecting the shape of the curve and how that relates to what's going on in gold and everything else. I'm kind of got a sneaky, spidey sense here that these things are all related in a way that makes sense, and somebody's going to come explain to us someday soon. I don't claim to know the answer.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is Saxo Bank Commodity Strategy Chief Ole Hansen. Eric, why did we get Ole back on the show this week?
Well, Ole is a commodities guy, and he's a good commodities guy. He's had some really good calls. He called that bottom in gold around 1680 or so. We almost made the call. We actually talked off the air. Both Ola and I had a feeling that this breakout was happening this week, but at the time we recorded it, we were still just below that 1833 key resistance level, and we decided to not try to call a breakout before its time. I guess maybe we should have done that. So you'll hear that in the interview. When we taped this on Tuesday, we were still below that level. I know Ola was expecting this breakout to occur, and I think that he thinks, as I think, that the move seems to be on for gold. Now, I have seen a little bit of analysis. Some people still think this is a fake break and we're headed back lower. You know, I've been surprised by things I thought were breakouts before, and we ended up turning back lower. So we'll see what happens. But so far, this looks really good to me. Let's get Ola's perspective on that and on many other things. I think you'll really enjoy this interview.
Eric's interview with Ole Hansen is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ola Hansen, who heads up commodity market strategy for Saxo Bank. Ola has prepared a fantastic slide deck for us. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the slide deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Ola, before we dive into the slide deck, I know you've been writing a lot about inflation. I don't know if you caught David Hay on this program recently coined this phrase greenflation, which I think perfectly explains how the goals of ESG are wonderful, but the way they're going about it by villainizing the energy industry is really, I think, setting us up for a big price shock in the future. Did you catch that interview? And what are your thoughts generally on secular inflation?
Well, good afternoon, Eric, and thank you very much for having me or inviting me back. I fully subscribe, and we at Saxo Bank fully subscribe to the non-transitory inflation outlook. The energy surge we've seen this year, or general commodity surge we've seen, is part of that process. Obviously, we come out of the pandemic. We've seen the global economy, which has been absolutely overstimulated, surge in demand for power around the world, and we're ending up with shortages all over the place. But part of that is also the transformation and the intense focus. You could almost argue that, it's quite clear that back in the 50s and 60s, we had an arms race. It was all about developing nuclear technology, and governments were throwing billions of dollars into it. This time around, we have another arms race, and that's the climate, and that's basically leading to billions of dollars being thrown into those efforts. And you can sometimes worry a little bit that the money not being used in the smartest way, but it is obviously also trying to send signals to the market and signals to population that something is being done. But we've seen this year how, especially in Europe and also in Asia, how we suddenly came short of power because we didn't have the gas we needed. So, and the wind and the sun was not producing the amount of energy that we had expected, and it just highlights how we can be left exposed, and the coming years is going to it's a development we continue to see, because the transformation will require a lot of energy, it will require a lot of mined metals, and if the companies are producers, mining companies are being villainized, and banks are not prepared to lend in the cash, or investors not prepared to put the money in, then obviously we do have a transformation which is just going to go become ever more expensive.
Ola, is the greenflation argument that David Hay presented valid? And in other words, is it really the focus on renewable energy that's going to increase the price of energy? Or is the price of energy just really increasing because of lack of investment, regardless of green factors?
I think it is a combination of both. First and foremost, the global demand has recovered, and it has recovered strongly following the pandemic and the collapse we saw in 2020. But going forward, the trajectory and demand tends to be relatively easy to work out. So I'll say the additional factor that has come into play is the uncertainty related to supplies, especially non-OPEC plus supplies, where we are seeing just look at the US, we dropped from 13 million, we're now back in the 11s, around 11.6, 11.9, and that's really how far the EIA in their latest update think we can see production go next year. So we're not seeing the response to these very profitable high prices that we got right now from producers, and that really is because their focus is somewhere else, and part to blame for that is not only the ESG, but also just simply the fact that they're somewhat worried that the transition will take place or will occur fairly quickly. That basically means within the next 10, 15 years, and that obviously leaves some of these bulgy billion-dollar projects in doubt, and that's part of the reason why we have these elevated prices.
Ola, I think that your view and mine are very closely aligned. I think we both see a secular inflation that lasts for many years and that we're just at the beginning of an epic commodity bull market. But anytime my views are aligned that much with the guest, I kind of feel an obligation as a journalist here to take the other side. So let's, for sake of argument, consider, wait a minute, what if you and I have this wrong? What if Janet Yellen has it exactly right, that inflation is transitory? And the reason we're seeing these spikes in commodity prices is just because, you know, we've got a global pandemic on that has disrupted supply chains. Those supply chain disruptions surely are going to, you know, get corrected sometime fairly soon here. And everything is going to all retrace. And it'll turn out that anybody who invested in a bull view on a long-term commodity bull market will have completely missed the boat and, you know, been upended and caught wrong-footed in the trade. Frankly, I'm quite willing to bet against that view. But for the sake of giving it some airtime, what would you say in response to that objection from an investor?
Well, I'm struggling to see that occur, Eric, and so I'm struggling to take the other side of the argument, because the demand looks strong, not only because the economies are recovering and we have the transformation which requires a big increase in supply. I think the devil's advocate should probably be China, because that's really where we see where we have such a huge amount of demand for most major commodities. But at the same time, they're going through a soft patch now. But again, we've seen in the past China do respond to weakness by adding support to the market. So even though they're going through a phase now, especially with focus on the property sector, which could hurt some of the metals, we did also see oil demand drop somewhat last month in October. I think that's really the only risk. But against that, we just had the infrastructure bill in the U.S. Coming through, and that infrastructure and green transformation will ensure that the demand remains robust. And into that, we obviously need supply to keep up. And again, the coming years, we just have to remember that commodity prices can rise even if demand doesn't, as long as supply is doesn't. If supply is struggling to keep up, then prices will move higher.
Okay, well, I tried to give at least a little bit of airtime to the other view, but let's go back to the one that you and I share, which is that as we come out of this pandemic, there will be increasing demand. The supply will be constrained by a number of logistic issues that will continue to exist for a long time. And among them is lack of investment, especially in the industries that have been targeted by ESG as supposedly being the bad guys. So when I look at this whole picture, you know, obviously energy is a very appealing thing to talk about. It's what I trade too. But, you know, let's look at the whole commodity picture, because one of the things that's really striking to me, okay, the big call here has been secular inflation. And I think we got that call right. And a lot of us who got that call right a couple of years ago said the big winner's got to be gold. And look at what's happened. We've got finally maybe the beginnings of a breakout as we're speaking today, but we're still below 1830, and that's been kind of the line in the sand that hasn't been crossed yet. And boy, copper is doing great. So what's the real inflation hedge in this environment? Is it gold or is it copper and other commodities?
Well, up until now, it has been oil and copper. Gold's had a troubled year because for several reasons. First of all, the uncertainty related to what the FOMC is going to do next. I think some of that uncertainty has now been cleared. We are going to get the taper finally. Interest rates, they are not too keen on getting involved with hiking anytime soon. And at the same time, in this environment, I think the biggest two things probably, if you look at the gold market, it has been mentioned about the crypto space attracting investors away from some of the metals. I think that's probably part of the story, but I think the main story is just simply we have VIX at such a low level. It means that physical gold demand right now is strong in Asia, in India. It's picking up as they recover from the pandemic. But if you look at the ETF holdings, they have been on a downward trajectory now for the past 18 months, and it is fund managers who piled into gold last year as a hedge. as volatility didn't really spike and we've seen the stock markets continue to rally, then the need to have diversification has really been suppressed. And that's I think that's probably the, one of the main reasons why gold has struggled, because right now we have finally in the bond market in recent months, last few months, started to see the inflation expectations start to build. At the same time, that's really only impacting the short end of the market, because or the yield rise we've seen has only been impacting the short end, because the longer end is more worried about growth going forward, and that has allowed real yields to drop to these current very low levels, nearly historic lows, below -1%. So that thing is that part of the equation is fully supported right now. Now we just need some more volatility in the stock market for gold really to shine. And you're a trader as well, Eric, and we know full well that one thing that drives markets are momentum, and we just simply haven't had any momentum in the gold market for a long time. And I think if you're looking at the chart, if we can take out that 1835 to 40 level, then not only does it point towards a break of the downtrend from the highs last year, but also that I think four or five times back in July and August we failed to break above that level. So if you do break that, that really will be the big test, because at that point money managers and technical traders, they will have to respond, and it is my belief they will do.
And if you look at the volume profile above 1840, there's room for a really big price acceleration above that level, if it happens. And it may have happened by the time this airs. We're actually recording this interview on Tuesday to air on Thursday, and we're right on teetering just below that critical level. So perhaps we'll have new news to report to our listeners by then. Let's go ahead and dive into your chart deck and look at some of the details on specific commodities. Starting on page 2, you're kind of painting the big picture here on commodities and breaking it out in different sectors, agriculture, metals, energy, and so forth. Energy seems like a very obvious one. What else should we think about in terms of the effects of this whole macro backdrop on commodities?
Well, I think first and foremost, I've been using the Bloomberg commodity indices for those commodities that are part of that basket. There are quite a few which has been marked, and you can see they're actually some of the best performing. That's gas in Europe. It's German power prices, the cost of emissions. These are really where they obviously stand out, with gas at one point up more than 300%. It has come down today because it looks like Putin is finally delivering on his promise to that Gazprom will supply additional gas over the coming weeks, and that should hopefully just alleviate some of the pressure on gas prices here. But generally, as you can see, there's really not many that many markets sticking out to the downside. And we talked about gold; it's flat on the year. And if you use gold as a hedge against the uncertainties elsewhere, it's been a brilliant year, because you don't really need any performance in gold when you have stock markets doing what they're doing right now, and bond markets still reasonably well behaved. So gold is sitting there and waiting for a rainy day. Remember what happened a couple of years ago when we had the worst months for equities since the 30s, 1930s. That was a really good month for gold. So let's not rule that one out at this stage. But otherwise, broad gains led by the energy sector. And after the recent small setback we've seen in industrial metals, part of that driven by China, with the industrial metals are, even despite of that, we're still up by a handsome, say, around 30%. It's difficult to see the scale when it goes all the way out to 300, but we've seen strong gains more or less across the board, and look for that to continue into 2022. What I think is interesting, if you look at the same slide, is also the speculative interest, because the market has become a little bit, or money managers has become a little bit lukewarm in recent months. There's actually been net selling ongoing now for the past six to nine, well, most of the year actually. We peaked in January in terms of net long held across 24 major commodities, and that does indicate that there is plenty of room, but also the fact that volatility has been rising in some of these markets, and that basically has forced some of these hedge funds to reduce exposure, because a lot of these, they are tracking volatility as part of their risk management, and as volatility goes up, then they have to cut exposure. So I think that's part of the story that explains why even though we're seeing Bloomberg commodity spot index at a multi-year high, we've seen a reduction in positioning over this year.
On page 3, your title says, tightness in energy and industrial metals still points to higher prices. Now, okay, help me understand that logic, because, boy, the price movement upward has already occurred very dramatically in both energy and in industrial metals. So what makes you say it's got further to go?
Well, this is just to explain what these charts are showing. It's basically the 12-month spread between the front futures contract and the contract 12 months out. And it's interesting if we look at the – I didn't put in the whole sector as a whole, but we can see some of these markets that we've had had several years. If you look at something like industrial metals, we had a half a decade from 15 to 20 where – basically, that spread was negative. That basically means the market was trading at contango. Spot prices were trading lower than the than further and futures prices further out the curve, indicating a market with ample supply. And the same goes for some of the other markets. Agricultural, especially, has been on a downward sloping trajectory for during that past that five year period as well. Whereas the energy has been a bit more on the plus side, to where we had been experiencing periods of tightness, and then we did have that massive slump last year when we saw oil prices go to negative in WTI, and that obviously caught some volatility in these spreads. But generally, right now we are seeing that for the first time in 5 years a solid backdrop for investments in commodities, because you have to remember that backwardation and contango is either hurting your investment or supporting your investment. When the market is in backwardation, you are having a positive role on a monthly basis. You're not, but the provider of your investment is rolling, selling expensive to buy the next one at a cheaper level. That roll yield is benefiting you as on your return, and that's what we've seen now very strongly in especially in the energy market and industrial metals, and it just tells us that the market is tight, and see very limited reason for that tightness to suddenly evaporate, because as for the reasons we talked about, and on the page as well, just some of the factors that that drives this focus on commodity super cycle, and as you can see, rising physical demand and tightening supply, and that supply is quite often tends to take time to come into the market. And I think the big difference now compared to previous cycles where we had tightness in the market is due to ESG, because the old saying that the best cure for high price is a high price, because it incentivizes production while potentially cutting demand. Those functions has to a certain extent been hurt by ESG, because we're not even though prices are moving up, we're not seeing the producer response that we may have or would have seen in previous cycles. So that's also still part of the story that's driving this tightness in the market.
Well, Ola, you just quoted one of my favorite sayings, which is the cure for high prices is high prices. And if you look at the backwardation that exists, particularly in the energy market, if you think like a commodity guy who hasn't been introduced to the new thinking of ESG, you'd think, boy, they've got to be really just opening the floodgates on CapEx to do major investments, and we should expect energy prices to take a nosedive a few years from now when all of those big capital expenditures that are being made now because of this price structure actually hit the market. So let's look at the next slide at how big those capital investments that are being made now actually are. Hey, wait a minute. Is this slide right?
It is indeed, Eric. And when we looked at it, it was actually my colleague Peter Garnry who pulled that out. And when we looked at it, we just couldn't believe what we're seeing. Basically, real capital expenditure so far this year is basically back to, and if that's for the MSCI World Materials and Energy Sector, we're basically back to levels we saw 20 years ago. And that's clearly not what we need at this moment in time, where demand is only expected to increase and remain firm over the coming years. And it's also telling that back then, we remember around the 2000s, that's when China entered the global stage as a major buyer of everything. Commodities took off, and it almost took a doubling of the Bloomberg Commodity Index between 2001 and 2005 before CapEx actually started to pick up. So that's how long it took before before money was really start to be spent on increased supply, because the market or the producers realized this is much longer term than we may perhaps had expected initially. And fast forwarding to today, we are potentially at the beginning of a similar move. This time around, it's not China, it's the green transformation and infrastructure spend that's going to be part of it. But are we going to see that response? And potentially that response could come quite a bit late.
And Ola, this is intuitively obvious to you and I because we both trade in energies. But just for the benefit of any listeners who are not seeing this, I want to make it super clear. What this chart is showing us is that oil comes from oil wells, and oil wells wear out over time. They have to be replaced, especially the newfangled shale ones, which wear out even faster than the old style. What's being done to invest in replacing the wearing out oil wells is exactly nothing, because it's fallen out of political favor to invest in energy companies. And I just can't see how this chart can be true and not lead to a major price crisis in the future. What am I missing that's not going to take us to oil prices to the moon in the next few years when we haven't made the investments we needed to make in replacing those declining shale wells that are not going to be able to continue to produce the same amount of oil that they do today?
Well, it's first and foremost really depends on the amount of spare capacity that OPEC plus countries still have available. I think there are some concerns that they may not be as high as we potentially could calculate, given the data that we've seen in the past, and we've got a slide a little bit later taking a look at that. So it is what's going to give. Well, it could be an economic slowdown. Basically, high prices kills growth. That's obviously not the avenue we want to go down, but that ultimately could be the risk that could help balance the market. But in the short term or medium term, we still have supplies coming from OPEC Plus, and that will take us well into next year, perhaps even 2023. But as you said, Eric, wells don't pump forever. They need to be replaced as they expire, and that's really the challenge. Which means that the sector constantly needs billions of dollars investments, and right now we're not getting it.
Okay, Ola, when I take a look at this graph on page 4, and I think about everything that I know and everything I've ever heard about OPEC spare capacity, lots of people in the industry passionately disagree about how much spare capacity OPEC really has. But, you know, it's somewhere between a couple of million barrels a day to 10 million barrels a day. It's not like they can turn the screws up and increase by 40 million barrels a day. I look at this graph and I look at what's going to happen to investment, and I know that demand is not going to zero overnight just because everybody wants an electric vehicle. That's not reality yet. It's coming. I just can't see how this graph is possibly going to be solved by OPEC plus spare capacity. Am I missing something? You guys study OPEC spare capacity more than I do. Is that really a potential savior here?
Well, that will be the savior, and again, when we had the focus here in Europe just a few months ago when the gas prices really took off, where there was some speculation would politicians fear blackouts more than climate change, and again, it's two horrible things that have to weigh up against each other. But if we do run into a period of prolonged high prices, then we could potentially see that resolve fade somewhat, but we need to get there. But at least over the coming years, at least the next 5 years, we need to rely on good old fashioned fossil fuels, and it still accounts for around 80% of the total global energy mix. 1% right now is renewables, 5% is nuclear. So those 80%, it will unfortunately take a much longer time than expected to get that down to reasonable levels.
Now, Ola, on page 5, you're arguing that an overstimulated global economy, because of the stimulative effects that central banks have done in reaction to COVID-19, presumably, have been driving this energy crunch. Does that mean that as that stimulation is no longer needed, that the energy crunch is going to be over?
No, because at the same time, I'll just rewind a little bit because this is part of what we talked about in the beginning, that we had this massive handouts from governments into the pandemic just to keep the wheels turning, and we all went on a spending spree, sending all our handouts to Asia in return for consumer goods. Power consumption in China accelerated very strongly. That required a lot of coal and gas to keep that power running, and that's why the Chinese demand suddenly took off in a strong way, and especially on the gas, because at the same time they're also trying to wean themselves off coal consumption, which is for now is not working, because they've had to increase production domestically in order to keep the power production or prevent them from having power cuts. So that was just the start of this overstimulation, and we now seen that spread to first the gas market, no, sorry, the coal market, and it spread to the gas market, and right now the gas markets has become the transitory energy, because if we need to move away from coal, then gas needs to be there to keep the turbines running on the days where the wind isn't blowing, and that basically means the demand for gas in Europe and in Asia will remain firm, and that competition for gas basically means that we have LNG in Asia and gas in Europe basically just taking off, moving far away from gas prices as you know them in the US. And I put in on this chart just for reference, just to show it's not scientific, but just to give a rough idea about how these gas prices are, what levels they're trading at if we price them in Brent. And as you can see, we at one point traded close to $200 a barrel. And historically as well, you can see that gas prices tend to trade below Brent. And this is obviously a golden opportunity for Russia, because they would like to have their long-term contracts reinstated. Question is whether anyone will buy gas on long-term contracts at these very current very very high levels. But you can see this market is out of whack, and the question is obviously how quickly we can get that normalized. And for now, with a very very cold winter potentially looming on the northern hemisphere once again, I think the competition for gas this winter will be quite intense, both from China and from in Europe.
Ola, moving on to page 7, we've got the crude oil rally coming into focus. And I should mention, just in the time we've been speaking, it's a Tuesday afternoon that we're recording this particular interview, and we have broken out above the short-term moving averages on WTI crude oil, back up almost to $84 as we're speaking, having opened 82-something this morning. So it looks like maybe the crude oil rally is back on as of this week. Do you agree with that? It seems like that's what you're showing or predicting here on your chart. If so, you got it right. And what comes next?
Well, I think just to before that, we just rewind one slide, because I think we need the gas, just the gas part of the oil equation right now. We talked about gas before, and then this is just highlighting again the gas prices in Europe and in Asia, and the gas to oil switch that really became a big talked about theme here during the past months. I think which has driven up oil price by at least $5 as we saw gas prices surge, we saw the substitution into fuel products. So I think the short-term key to oil is probably to a certain extent again being driven by gas, because if we do see Russian supplies to Europe pick up and gas prices come back below this gas to switch area, then that potentially could take some of the sting out of oil, because demand may just stabilize somewhat. But you are right, Eric. We've taken out that very, very long downtrend that we had from the highest back in 2008. We moved higher today on Tuesday, and that's actually interesting enough, because we're trading higher today because the EIA report was actually a bit dovish. That basically meant the market was removing or they were thinking that the risk of an SPR release was less likely. So that's why oil prices are somewhat higher here this Tuesday. But I think over the next months or so, gas could be a major theme for the oil market. If we should see prices come down, that would help just at least in the short term take some of the sting out of the rally in crude oil. But if you look at Brent here, 86.75, we're not far away from it. That's the recent highs from 2018. If you do break that, then the call for $100 will start to strengthen. But I think also at the same time, and we talked about that, where can the extra barrels come from? Because that really is a key right now. And I think just looking at the OPEC Plus meeting recently, where they just went for another 400,000 barrel increase, we have to remember that what they're agreeing to increase is not really what's actually hitting the market, because we have two laggards right now, and that's shown here on page 7, Nigeria and Angola. They are currently producing combined 450,000 barrels a day less than the, what they can according to their quota. And that's a full month increase at plus some that we're not getting into the market. So so I think in order to help stabilize price, we really need to see these two countries get their production back up, and the outlook for that is not terribly promising. One area that could be promising is Iran, because we got the nuclear negotiation resuming here at the end of the month. Again, Iran knows full well that the U.S. is quite desperate to get prices down, and they potentially hold the key to that, because they have, compared to the recent peaks back in 2017-18, they have 1.2 million barrels of additional supply that they could increase production by. Probably not that much, because there is a lot of oil probably leaving Iran covertly that we don't really don't get counted, but still it's a sizable increase that could come from an Iranian or the removal of sanctions. So I think that's really what we should be looking at over the coming months, to see if there's any sign of a relief coming from that front. But looking at the U.S. strategic reserves are coming down, rightfully so, because there's no need for them at these current very high levels, because imports into the U.S. has come down during the past decade. But at the same time, we talked about U.S. production earlier, and the EIA today in their forecast, they see production in December this year around 11.6. They see the average for next year around 11.9. So it's only a 300,000 barrel increase over the next 12 months, and that's really far cry from the 13 million barrels they produced before the pandemic. So we probably need to focus on OPEC and their ability to increase production in order to avoid that we are going to talk about potentially 100 barrel oil next time we speak.
Let's come back to that 13 million barrel figure for the United States production. I've heard a lot of other people tell me that it's basically impossible to ever get back to that, because that happened as a result of the shale revolution and the incredible mountain of easy money that was available thanks to Federal Reserve largesse. Junk bond market was very supportive of the oil patch in that time frame. What people are telling me is that's just not true anymore. The money is not there. We don't have easy money to fund these things. It's much harder to get financing. And it's impossible to get back to 13 million because of that. But at the same time, a lot of people who told me we were going to just be in permanent decline didn't forecast that we are seeing at least a slow recovery in U.S. production. So what's the real story here? How much can the U.S. recover?
Well, it's somewhere in between, I think, because I just recently made an update on some of the market caps for the 15 biggest shale oil producers in the U.S. and obviously realized that quite a few of them had disappeared from the face of the earth during the past 18 months, because they've been taken over by larger entities, and I think that's part of the reason why we're not going to see a return, because the willingness to pump at will and just take on accumulate a lot of debt to do that is well and truly that has been put to rest. So it's more whether some of these more much bigger oil companies are following several mergers, whether they have the incentive to ramp up production, which they obviously can if they feel they're allowed to, and if they can see it makes economic sense, then that is an option. But the kind of production binge that we had leading up to that collapse before the pandemic, is difficult to see that being repeated. But again, the best cure for high price is a high price, and again, land areas are available to increase production. So, but in order for that to happen, we still have to remember as well, shale oil producers don't necessarily sell oil at $84 a barrel. They're selling at forward prices, which are with a very, very steep curve we have right now, selling at forward at much lower prices than the one we see on our screen. So that's also a thing that has to be taken into consideration.
On page 8, I see you've got a chart showing the December 21 through December 22 backwardation spread. That happens to be one that a lot of our Macro Voices listeners bought in contango at minus 3 spot 20 and have ridden all the way up. So one of my favorite spreads. What's going on? Why is it on your chart? And what is it telling us about the market?
Well, it's just I brought it with me because there's been quite a lot of focus on Cushing, Oklahoma recently, and I think that's part of the speculative interest, which tends to be concentrated at the front of the curve, which to a certain extent can drive maybe the backwardation a little bit out of whack compared to what's actually what the supply and demand actually looks like. We have been seeing the emergence of a real threat to supplies because Oklahoma crude stocks has been shrinking as fast as they've been doing in recent months. And we have to remember it was also Oklahoma that or Cushing that was the reason why we hit $40 briefly, minus $40 briefly last year. And this time round it's the opposite, because well, back then we were worried about tank tops. We're now worried about hitting low points where the whole system is not functioning well enough. But there are signs that I think we're just seeing some reports that some of the price differential between especially Midland has moved more in favor of WTI, and that should lead to more supplies hitting Cushing. So I think it's just for reference that if you're watching the curve, you should also be watching what's going on at Cushing, because it is obviously the landlocked delivery point for WTI futures.
Ola, let's shift gears and move on to gold bullion on page 9. What's going on here?
Well, as we talked about at the beginning, that top of the show, we are getting close to a level. This chart is a little bit below that level, but we are currently challenging, or getting very close to once again challenging, that 1835 level. And as we talked about, the real yields developments are currently very supportive. We've got real yields moving firmly into negative territory, and we have to remember that the way you construct a nominal yield is basically taking the inflation part, and then you end up with the real yield. And as inflation expectations are, break evens are expected to remain elevated. And if nominal yields are not going anywhere due to growth worries, then real yields will continue to remain into deeply negative territory. And that's a key source of inspiration for gold, or at least has been in the past. I would argue at current levels, if you look at the real yields, gold is probably somewhere around $40 to $50 too cheap. I should have put a chart where I showed the correlation between the two, but based on recent history, I would say that that gold is trading cheap at these levels. So it's more a question that the market comes to the conclusion that these real yields are going to stick around these deeply negative levels for a long prolonged period of time, and that combined with the prospect for inflation to remain elevated, for economic growth to potentially be challenged, I think that is that's setting up for a renewed upside attempt in gold. And as if we do take out that 1835 level, then I could see that market pop $100 relatively quickly, because we will see renewed momentum from a lot of speculative traders who have been looking elsewhere while we've been trading range bound for the past 6 to 9 months.
I definitely agree with that outlook, and as we're speaking, we're still looking at 1831, so we're close, but not quite. Maybe by the time this airs, we'll already have the breakout underway. We'll see what happens. Moving on to page 10, though, copper. Boy, copper's doing better than gold in an inflation environment. I was expecting gold to be the outperformer.
Yeah, and copper is actually doing incredibly well. If you think about all the worries that we had about China during the past 3 months, especially the property sector, which is a key source of demand for copper due to all the wiring and electrical wirings and so on. And despite of this, we have not even had a 38.2% retracement of the rally that from the March low last year. We stopped short. I'm using high-grade copper in New York as a reference, and as you can see, we found quite a solid floor around that $4 pound level. The recent spike up to near the record high we had back in May was triggered by some almost call it shenanigans in the London market, where big firms were hoovering off stocks, thereby driving the visible stock levels down, creating a sense of shortage in the market, and that was some of that was given back, but But just look at the exchange monitored inventories there on slide 10. We are dealing with levels which is approaching the lowest levels in more than a decade. And some of that can obviously be taken out for speculative purposes, taken out of visible storage into invisible warehouses where it's not being monitored. That creates a sense of tightness in the market. But it's happening right now, both on the LME, and it's also happening in Shanghai. So it does indicate to me that gold is still one of the king of the, I would call it the king of the green metals, because just look at the whole electrification, electrical vehicles, the supply which potentially could construct to keep up, and also the speculative interest from money managers, which is also is part of my weekly update, which is available on Mondays. You can see the speculative interest is right now is probably around half of what we had when we visited those highs on a previous occasion. So plenty of room for funds to get involved. I'm not chasing it right now because I think we still need to get China growth worries and with the developments there out of the way. So I cannot rule out that we could on a rainy day see it break below four to challenge that 377. But I think that whole area below $4 is a buy for a longer term move to fresh record highs.
Moving on to page 11, you make the argument that we need metal prices to be high in order to have the energy transition work. I understand what you mean, but I'm not sure everybody does. Please explain.
It's all to do about what we talked about earlier, that we need high prices to incentivize mining operations to maintain a solid funnel of new supply to meet these increased demands over the coming years. And as you can see, it's we're not just talking about a couple of metals. It's almost a whole the spectrum of industrial metals that in some way or another can be used and will be used towards that transition. So we need all of them.
And let's talk about weather on page 12. How does that come into the equation?
Just because we haven't talked too much about weather, and again, when people ask, well, what's your outlook for weather for the agricultural production? Well, I think, I'm not a weather man or someone sitting above us all, looking down, deciding what's going to happen next. But what we can see is that there is a risk of another La Niña building over the coming months, and that that will create, if that becomes as strong as it was last year, that will once again create some worries about the supplies or outlook for crop production in South America, and to a certain extent also the U.S. So we focus there on the key crops, wheat, corn, soybeans, but also I'll say Brazil-centric commodities such as sugar, coffee, and just returning to the U.S. Cotton as well, which cotton will be competing with other crops. And I think also, once again, just mention the gas surge, because it has led to a phenomenal rally in fertilizer prices. And if you have high diesel costs and you have high fertilizer prices, that is a risk to production next year, because some farmers may opt to use less fertilizer, and that could obviously bring the crop production in doubt. So unfortunately, from a global perspective, I think we have to worry a little bit about the agricultural space, that prices there will continue to rise as well.
And finally, on page 13, uranium and nuclear power, a subject that we covered with a whole special back when it was time to buy it, right here on Macro Voices.
Yeah, and I think that's just it's just again this whole thing about how do we go about the transition in the smartest way. And we had a podcast in Saxo Bank recently where we had invited one of a local company in to discuss some of the new technologies that they're working on. And one thing is for sure, that if nuclear power is known and the new generations of nuclear technologies are somewhat more safe and easier to and faster to build than the technologies we know today, which most of them were developed back in the 50s and 60s. So we see a future for uranium and nuclear, or for nuclear power, because it is the fastest way to achieve the base load that is required, so we can get rid of coal to begin with, and then over the coming decades reduce the need for something like gas. But I think it's a long-term view, so I think investors there has to be patient. We've seen some volatility this year, especially with the Sprott ETF joining the fray. But I think we just have to keep in mind it is a long-term prospect for the sector. So do not expect very big moves in the short term. But it is mostly certainly a sector that I believe will continue to attract demand over the coming years.
Well, Ola, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to fill our listeners in on where they can follow the work that you do there at Saxo Bank, because you guys have your own commodity podcast, which you actually produce. Tell us about that and what else they can do to follow your work.
Well, you mentioned the podcast. It's not only commodities. It is a macro-based commodity podcast that we do on a daily basis from our headquarters here in Copenhagen. And we just basically take the temperature on the market, what happened overnight, and potentially where we go next. It's gained a lot in popularity over the last couple of years. So that's really, I would say, our flagship production. We also got a quick take every morning that is available at analysis.saxo. Otherwise, you can always follow us on our individual Twitter profiles. I put in the individual Twitter profiles there on the slide 14 as well.
Well, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, Ola. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value: cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Ola back on the show. I mean, he's by far one of my favorite commodity guests to have on. He's just so smart and on the ball with so many of these things. And it's just, you know, when I heard in the interview him talking about, you know, the oil service industry and just how there's still a lack of investment in this, it makes me think like there's got to be still such an extraordinary opportunity in the years to come as this has to all work out. Like there's going to be a catch-up period in this. It's certainly on my mind, and I'm curious whether or not this is thinking about how to trade this. There's going to be an opportunity here for sure.
I agree, and Ola is one of my favorite guys as well. But I want to move on now to your tour of the commodity markets chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for this chart deck in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, we've got the dollar index, and boy, look at that breakout that jumps off the page on the right edge there of page two. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's still a very bullish looking chart. And obviously, one thing that me and you talk about all the time is that it's all relative to other fiat currencies. So we're just talking about, you know, which fiat currency is the hot one in any short period of time there. But there's definitely a dollar breakout. And what's interesting about this is that that hasn't really taken too much of the wind out of the sails of the commodity markets. Typically, over decades of intermarket analysis, usually commodities tend to do poorly in periods of dollar strength. And yet that doesn't seem to be manifesting at all in this window. And obviously, there's actual real supply issues that are overriding any currency correlations. But it is interesting that we're getting a gold breakout and some of these other commodities we're just going to talk about here in a moment, at the same time as the dollar is pretty much breaking out of a one-year range. I'm curious whether the dollar will make the stick and what will happen from here.
Patrick, let's move on to crude oil futures on page three.
Right. And so the interesting part to me that I wanted to observe is, like, even let's say if you go back into the July, August part of the summer period where oil, you know, went from the mid to low 70s down to like to the low 60s, it was about a $10 correction. But generally, you could argue that throughout the entire 2021 year, there was oil was structurally bullish and poised to go higher. But there are periods when crude oil goes through corrections. The interesting part about the reversal that happened yesterday is it rejected oil along its previous highs. And that while that in itself one day is not enough information to make a market call, it'll be really interesting to see whether this continues to be a period where oil now consolidates and or backfills some of that extraordinary bullishness we had through September and October. And watching whether or not it can get north of 85 in the coming days is on my mind.
Well, I'll tell you, in this case, I tend to actually discount the value of technical analysis, because technical analysis is really based on figuring out what the traders are thinking. And I think this is more about political theater. I say that the fundamentals are still very strong for a continued crude oil rally, but the political risk of Joe Biden managing to figure out what to say to freak markets out to get the price back down to, oh, let's say where the highs were in July, you know, around, what is that, $73, $74? I could easily see that happening from here, or I could see it just being straight uphill from here if we don't have too much political influence. I think we are going to have more political influence. So I'm waiting for more down, and, you know, hopefully I'll be smart enough to pick the bottom and add to my longs there. But
I'm with you that it's a buy on dip. It's just the question is that does it go and give a much better tactical entry at a better price, right?
Right. And I don't think it's possible to use technical analysis to figure out where that is. It could be right here, right now, today is the bottom. And it could easily be that we're down to, you know, low 70s again on some kind of really trumped up White House rhetoric about how supposedly they're going to battle with OPEC Plus or whatever it is. But if that's not confusing enough, let's go to the famous Widowmaker contract, which is natural gas futures. If I said I wasn't sure what was about to happen next with crude oil, I'm double not sure what's going to happen next with natural gas.
Well, you know what? I mean, there was a seasonality trade and all sorts of, you know, weather considerations and things. But nat gas had just an extraordinary run for over 6 months where we went from basically, for rounding, went from like 2.5 up to like 6.25 to the upside on that nat gas continuous contract. It was just an amazing bull run that had a real acceleration to the upside. But what we can really see now over the last month is that we've now entered far more of a trade range up along these highs, and all of that upside momentum that was built coming out of the summer has now dissipated. The question really here is maybe from a seasonality perspective, is that all we're going to get on this particular cycle? You know, usually once the winter has been fully priced in, usually we have some, especially on the continuous contract, it rolls down the term structure into the summer. It'll be interesting whether this is going to be, at least for this leg of the bull, all that we're going to get.
Well, let's take a look at gold futures on page 5. Boy, that breakout above the trend line really stands out, and I think this is the real one, but we'll see what happens. I suppose we need to get above those May highs before we really have a confirmed breakout.
Right. I mean, in the end, there's confirmation, and then there's also when traders actually enter. And I would argue that many traders are entering with the anticipation that it'll be confirmed with the break above the 1900 level where those previous highs were. But one thing to highlight was that there was an extraordinary bull run in gold in 2019 going into the summer of 2020. And we really have spent a year with gold just in a deep consolidation. When you really step back, and I wanted to focus on a weekly chart, so when you really step back, gold has not really done anything bearish. I think the thing that bothered everyone was simply the fact that the rest of the commodity markets were rallying and gold just didn't want to participate on the upside. And therefore, many people just viewed it as dead money on the short term. But overall, I think that the consolidation still can very much be leaning toward a very bullish chart in the much bigger picture. And like when you step back and look at, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of charts, this still looks like it's in a primary bull trend, and it looks like this could be a place where it turns up. Obviously, one day doesn't make a new breakout. I don't want to already be getting overly excited about just a couple good days, but this is sometimes how bull markets begin, and it'll be really interesting to see, or at least another bull leg higher begins, and it'll be interesting to see whether this is where the breakout happens.
You know, both Ola and I couldn't put our fingers on this when we talked off the air, but this was before the breakout above that line really happened this week that we had this conversation, and we both just had a feeling of something feels like this is it. It was the action and the vigorous action of the breakout from below 1800 and how quickly it got up to 1833. And at that point, it hadn't broken above it. But both Ola and I were feeling like it's about to. We just had a feeling. And sure enough, that's what's happening. So I think it's on. I think the gold bull market is back on. We'll see. But while we're talking precious metals, why don't we include platinum, Patrick? Why do we have platinum here on page six?
Now, Eric, so we got this platinum chart up here on page six, but I also just wanted to note before we talk platinum, just on what's going on in silver. While I don't have a chart up, what's interesting is silver actually has been trading in a pretty good correlation to gold. And without silver breaking that key level above 25, where I would argue a lot of resistance levels, silver does look like it's ready to go as well. And so this is where I wanted to just focus more on the other ones, like in this case, platinum. And what's interesting is platinum has pretty much followed the same timeline script as gold, which is more or less spent most of this year just consolidating off of its highs. And it's more or less retraced about half of the prior bull run that it had from the COVID lows and is now also turning up. And it'll be really interesting to see whether the entire precious metal space is breaking out together. And that would actually add certainly more support to the idea that gold's going to work.
Or I guess the question that begs is whether the entire commodity complex is breaking out together. And hey, take a look at page seven, wheat futures.
You know, the wheat futures have actually been quite bullish, even arguably for much of the year. I mean, there was a little bit of a summer pullback in wheat, but really grains have, it's been a tale of multiple grain markets. Like for instance, the soybean has really actually been the dog and the laggard, but wheat broke into fresh new highs. The pullbacks are being bought on dip and continues to look very healthy. And it's really interesting to see that the grains, even corn has finally based and is starting to roll up. It'll be interesting to see whether the grains really start running from here.
But if you move to base metals and look at copper futures on page eight, you know, I would have expected copper futures to be pressing new all-time highs with everything else that's going on. And they're just barely maybe bottoming, it looks like, on what may have been a consolidation.
Well, Eric, you know, my thought on that is, and I'm just asking more as a question as opposed to a conclusion, but like maybe it's the drag coming from the last 3 months of what's going on in China. Just, you know, iron ore continues to dog, and a lot of the industrial metals are a bit of laggards in this window. And so it'll be interesting to see, like maybe this is just offering a phenomenal opportunity to be buying copper at reasonable prices, because I'm sure it will resolve itself. There's a lot of fundamental reasons why copper can still go much higher in this EV revolution and the way that the things are evolving in the entire ESG movement. So nonetheless, copper, it's basing, it's at a key support line. It has not broken out for a technical thing, but what will be interesting to see in the next week or two is whether copper breaks 450 on the upside. I mean, if we see that it finally shows like it's coming back to life, it may very well be ready for another leg higher, but it certainly has not had the breakout candle that we've seen on a lot of the other commodities. So it's certainly a very early time to be watching whether copper starts to turn bullish, because it hasn't yet broken out.
Let's take a look at the soft commodities. We've got a couple of charts for sugar and coffee futures.
Yeah, like overall, what's interesting is that they're all sort of setting up like almost like where wheat was a couple months ago. You know, tested overhead resistance on numerous occasions. You can see sugar up along that high, or you look at that chart on coffee futures, retesting the high multiple times. And in both these charts, you're seeing them winding up like they're ready to go for a 52-week high breakout. Now, have they broken out yet? No, but this is a really interesting moment to see whether we see many of these softs breaking out. I know like cotton has already taken off and a couple of these others are moving. So watching whether coffee and sugar join the party is something that's on my mind.
Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you don't have to wait for Thursday every week. You can get them every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. Information's on page 11 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Today, you're going to find that transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Ola Hansen's slide deck in the chart book we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to a Jeffrey Snyder piece on how bond yields astutely, accurately sort out past inflation panics, and a Bill Blaine article on bond yields, Fed head, and unsustainable markets. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.